The library is, as you know, exceedingly old. It was founded in 1754, hence it is more than a quarter of a millennium old. George Washington browsed here, a true fact. Yes, the New York Society Library is very, very old. So we make a habit of doing new things. For example, we use new technology such as computers. And some of the rooms have Wi-Fi, though not this room. Tonight, we used a very long cable from downstairs to get onto the internet. Old and new. Now I would like to read you a poem entitled New York Society Library Haiku. Someone dusts the books. The grandfather clock chimes. The librarian tweets. Because of its classy uptown name, the library is thought to be, by some, exclusive. Not so. The writer Ved Mehta, a library member, says, quote, "My only quibble with the library is its name, for which there are good historical reasons, but which belies the democratic function it serves," unquote. In other words, the library is just like you and me. Except that Ved Mehta is a member here. Mr. Mehta, if you should ever start tweeting, I will follow you. Tonight we are having a salon. What is a salon? To find out, let's go to a democratic source, Wikipedia. A salon is a gathering of people under the roof of an inspiring host, held partly to amuse one another and partly to refine taste and increase the knowledge of the participants through conversation. These gatherings often consciously followed Horace's definition of the aims of poetry, either to please or to educate. No doubt you have remarked on my resemblance to Mabel Dodge, late patron of the arts. A century ago, Mabel Dodge held a successful New York City salon for artists, reformers, and radicals. To find out more about her, I looked on the internet. Turns out she's on Facebook. Facebook had some basic facts and a mention of a troubled liaison with a chauffeur. Next, I checked a book out of the Society Library's collection. The book says that Mabel Dodge, quote, "did not follow current fashions, but always dressed in long robes and often covered her head with floppy hats, huge turbans, or flowing scarves. The total picture was appealing to men and women alike, and members of both sexes seemed quite regularly to fall in love with her." Who knows what might happen at a salon? What will certainly happen at this one is two presentations and refreshments. One of the new things we do here at the library is sit around reading current periodicals. And tonight's salon will focus on literary magazines. This is our second annual literary magazine salon. It is part of The Writing Life, a series of talks and events curated by Miss Carolyn Waters. Representatives of two magazines have come to tell us about their publications. The first, BOM, comes out 4 times a year. It aims to deliver the artist's voice through the 21st century as a multi-platform brand. We will be told what that means later on. For 30 years, BOM has been publishing conversations between artists, writers, actors, directors, musicians, and architects. BOM also publishes First Proof, a literary supplement. Also, they sell t-shirts that say BOM on them. BOM's founders named the magazine after a journal called Blast. I'll come right out and say that the trend concerned us, but we searched the editors discreetly at the door and found no explosives on their persons. 30 years is an accomplishment, pretty old, though only 0.03% of a millennium. The new issue is 1 month old, which is to say brand new. We look forward to whatever bomb drops. The second magazine, Electric Literature, comes out quarterly also. Electric Lit is 1 year old, or 0.01% of a millennium. Hot off the presses. It is a short story anthology whose mission is to use new media and innovative distribution to return the short story to a place of prominence in popular culture. The cover of Electric Literature's last issue featured a naked man, which was, of course, both shocking and stimulating. hence electric. We got a charge out of the cover. Mabel Dodge once held an evening discussion on the topic of magazines, just like this one. Unfortunately, that evening degenerated into finger-pointing and rude confrontation, but we will be optimistic. Mainly, Mabel Dodge's salon was, the lady later wrote, a kind of home for many people who came and sat there and gave their souls a little fun. So that they may please and educate us, so that our souls can have a little fun, we will welcome these editors. After a short video, Paul Morris, general manager of Bomb Magazine, will take the mic. Enjoy it.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. Thank you, Sally, for that great introduction. Sally was a contributor to our 2007 summer issue, and we don't have that for sale tonight, but you can check it out online. It's really, really nice to be here and an honor. Thank you for inviting us. And the first voice you heard on that video was our founder and editor-in-chief. Her name is Betsy Sussler, and she would have been here tonight had she not been back at the office closing the new issue, which will go to press in about a month. It's very nice to be here. I'd like to say I've been looking forward to being here because I've known the society for a while. I lived on the Upper East Side for my first 2 years as a young editorial assistant at a publishing company in Manhattan. But I'm afraid to say I can't say that. I've never been here before, but it's really an amazing, amazing place, and it's quite lovely to discover it. And I feel embarrassed to not have known about it until now. So thank you for having us. And that video that you saw was just a small little sort of glimmer of some of what BOM has been up to this year. It's our 30th anniversary, and I have the issue right here in my hands. You can take a look. You also have a postcard on your seats, I think. This is for sale outside. You can take a look at that and see if it's something you want to buy. We're offering a subscription tonight for readers. You can get all issues are for sale for $5, usually $8. And subscriptions are $20, usually 20, that's about 40% off the cover price. And if you'd like a BOM t-shirt, which Sally mentioned, you can get a joint t-shirt and a subscription for the low price of $30. But we're not really here to be a commercial venture. And that actually brings me to the main point, which is BOM. Even though we're 30 years, we still feel like we're sort of a newcomer to the scene, and that's primarily because we're a nonprofit organization. We rely heavily on the support of donors and subscriptions and the state. We receive a lot of funding from various grants that we get. And in that regard, we're part of this sort of great ecosystem of publishers and writers with Electric Literature, with Triple Canopy, who's here tonight. And we've featured Nathan Englander in our pages before. And we're all based in Brooklyn, which is probably not surprising to a lot of people to know that there's a big publishing scene happening there. But even though BOM started in Tribeca about 30 years ago around a kitchen table, we really retain this sort of independent grassroots spirit, and that's what we're celebrating in our 30th. So with videos like this and some other things you can see online, and also our back issues, which I'll just quickly sort of wave around. Through the years, BOM has taken a couple different turns in terms of being an art magazine to being having a go at a more commercial look. These are some large, oversized issues from the first couple of years in the 80s, and you're welcome to come take a look at them later on in the night, but they're really, really pretty funky, if you ask me. They're oversized. They're printed on newsprint. The ink gets on your hands pretty pretty quickly. They're turning yellow as we speak. But they're beautiful. They're objects, and they're things that you definitely want to hold. Over the years, we've changed the format because we're subject to newsstand demands and expectations. So there's a period in the mid-90s where BOM looked like this, and we got a little bit more sort of interested in layout and commercial sort of appeal. So you can see how things started changing here. And then with the ongoing cost or ongoing rise of paper costs, we became a little bit more newsstand friendly, and so the trim size changed even further, and we became more colorful. Let's see if there's any color in here. Maybe you can see a little color. So I'm really glossing through these, but you feel free to flip through them later on. They're really they are art objects. We feel that they're important to be in people's hands, and we have a slideshow that we'd like to put up, and I'd like to actually, before we go to the slideshow, just talk a little bit about what's been going on with our 30th anniversary. We just celebrated a big event at Capitola. It's our fundraiser, and that one fundraiser helps us with half our operating budget for the year. And so, you know, BOM started as a magazine that was written, produced, printed by artists and writers and musicians. It continues to be staffed by artists and writers and musicians. No one draws a substantial salary. Everyone sort of does this as a labor of love, and that's still it's the spirit that in which it was started 30 years ago. It's still the spirit today, and so this fundraiser was a big success for us, and we're really happy that it's over. It was kind of exhausting to have put on. And so we're looking forward to sort of doing some things for the next 7 or 8 months of this year that are a little bit more approachable for people. They're free events. BOM tends to do free events, concerts and readings and conversations between artists. Sally mentioned this at the beginning of the introduction, but BOM is really primarily a magazine where artists and writers and musicians and filmmakers get to talk about whatever they want to talk about. As a nonprofit, we make it our mission to basically say to them, whatever you want to talk about, that's good for us, as long as it's about the creative process, as long as it's about something that is meaningful and substantial, and we pair a writer in conversation with a painter or a filmmaker in conversation with a poet, and so on, and we let them talk about their own work in a way that really isn't replicated anywhere else. Part of what goes on behind the scenes at BOM, which we don't really celebrate too much, is the curation of these pairings. For instance, in the current issue, we had Thomas Pletzinger's interview. He's a first-time novelist whose Funeral for a Dog is out now, and he was telling us a little bit about what his work was like and how he was writing his novel, his first novel, and he said, during this period, I was listening to a lot of music by Sufjan Stevens, and so we reached out to Sufjan and said, would you like to interview Thomas for our 30th anniversary, and they both were really gung-ho to do it, and it's a great interview, and it's in this issue, and I recommend it. And in addition, Sally mentioned the conversations that we publish are really sort of the meat of the magazine, but we also do a literary supplement called First Proof, and that is about a 32-page, 35-page little booklet that has in the past looked like this. Was your poetry in a book like this? Yeah, it was. And now it's built into the magazine. That's a little bit more newsstand-friendly. These used to drop out of the magazine. Hard to keep contained. The First Proof Literary Supplement really features a lot of emerging poets and writers. We partner with a lot of independent publishers, and we get tips, we get feedback from people who say, you know, we love what you did, would you consider publishing this new author and translation. We champion the works of emerging writers and poets, and we definitely try to make it a point to publish as much literature and translation as possible. It's hard because it's not as commercially viable, but it's really part of our mission to make sure that these works that aren't getting represented well in the U.S. Have representation in our magazine. I think at this point I'll show a slideshow. It's a little bit of our history. I'm going to go through it pretty quickly. And at one point or another, I might invite Richard Goldstein, our archive editor, up to the podium to go a little bit more in depth about what you're seeing. This is a cover from issue number one as a photograph by Sarah Charlesworth. And it's this year been our calling card for almost all of our events. It's the issue that really helped our current design team reimagine what BOM's layout and look could be. If we were to compare this to that, it's a little bit different, much more colorful, but the logo changed to adapt, and the interior layouts really started looking a little bit more like the scrappy roots from which BOM came. So I'm going to try to remotely do this. And Richard, anytime you want to chime in here, come on up.
Through time, through the 30 years, like you have a bit of it gives you perspective on how the ideas were originally taking form through the kind of scene of the table or the big conversation that it was bubbling up from. And this is like the first kind of America's issue that we did. And later, later in the late 90s, we started the America's issue formally. So it's interesting to see like the ideas, the early seeds happen in ways that later became formalized into, a kind of packaged mission that we do.
Yeah, so for about 11 years straight, BOM published from 2000 to 2008, BOM published something called the America's Issue, which was dedicated to a different region of Latin America every year. It was Cuba one year, Haiti another year, Colombia, Venezuela. We did two issues, one on Mexico and the Gulf states, and then another just on Mexico itself. And so this is an example of how this was a glimmer in our eye back in 1983, and it really didn't get sort of codified or formalized until 2000. So that's sort of just a sense of how the magazine's evolved over the years. And Richard touched on something I didn't really quite address. This really was started around a kitchen table in Tribeca in 1981, and the writers and poets and painters who were in the room at the time really were just saying, wouldn't it be great to have our own magazine where we could talk about our own work in a way that friends talk about it, that not the way critics are talking about it, because the conversations that they were having that afternoon around the kitchen table were just so, I guess, robust and chock-filled of sort of honest, deep, intimate material. And so that was the genesis of BOM. So we're just going to show you some layouts real quick and flow through them quickly.
the one kind of fashion issue that we did. It wasn't formally a fashion issue, but we used to have a fashion section. I mean, I imagine it was like all the, maybe due to like the geography, like New York, like it was, I mean, we're still like all the artists working together, but maybe it was more dense in a certain area, like the designers and the artists and the writers, but it was a part of the magazine at the time, the fashion, and it's just kind of neat to see.
Since BOM is really about conversations between artists, we have included some quotes that we think are seminal and that are sometimes insightful. I'll let that one sit on screen for a second. It's amazing sometimes to look back through our archives because a lot of times, you know, a lot of names that you just take for granted now, back in the 80s, they were really still emerging, and BOM was there to either work with them to develop these conversations, or else they were a part of the genesis of the magazine.
Was really always kind of had a political edge to what we were talking about or what the artists were bringing to it. It was about the art first and, you know, the kind of the ideas behind it, and it never kind of turned away from, you know, what was going on with the artists' lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not being a totally commercial magazine, BOM didn't put the date on all of its covers and chose to leave certain key elements off, but we tried to fix that over the years. BOM covers represent, if you just looked at all 115 of them, they really are a great little slideshow in themselves. We just put in a few of our favorites. We hope you like them.
This is kind of, this was from the first issue, and this is a little film review of Underground USA, but it kind of represents, I think, the whole magazine just in one little spread, you know, just how it started.
This is a pretty good indication of how BOM was created. You know, back in the 80s and 90s, paste-up boards were used to put magazines together, and they were gluing things, and they were putting headlines and decks and various cut-up methods to put the magazine before it was photographed and then printed. And Francine Prose was just one of our honorees at our big 30th anniversary last week.
When we started putting the portraits up on the cover, like Paul mentioned, when we reformatted it back in the 90s, this is one of the first ones.
Again, just I mean, the fact that Kiki Smith and Chuck Close are in conversation with each other here, and you don't have some journalist or some sort of different writer or person having that conversation with either one of them is testament to what BOM really does well. If you have the chance to read the William Dafoe interview with Frances McDormand, it's really entertaining. It's right around the time that Fargo came out, and it's online for free.
This is the first proof, and it's kind of cool. It started like we have it now, an insert in the magazine, like a full insert. It wasn't a small book, but it's kind of cool because there's a little piece, Derek Jarman, and stuff in there.
How much of your archive is
available? I was going to get to that, but we have all of our interviews online for free. So in the time machine that we've been traveling for a bit, but now we've only traveled 15 years with this cover. So we'll try to speed this up and get to some other aspects of what Baum's up to. But this was our 15th cover.
It was always really like a design. The object was really central to what we do, and even like you have these really crazy text layouts, especially in the 90s, it got really funky with the fonts and everything, and that was always the style, was always a main concern of the magazine, how you're receiving the stuff, the material. And we always, It's kind of funny that there is a kind of prescient nature that we had, because back in, you know, the 90s, we had Sapphire on the cover, and, you know, a few years ago. So, I mean, there was kind of this thing we're tapping into, you know, emerging or talents that would break.
Yeah, this is 1994. This is when Precious had just come out, or maybe just prior to it. And as we know, Precious was made into a movie about a year and a half ago. When people come up to us sometimes at various literary fairs or various readings, and they say, "Oh, who's going to be covered in Baum in the upcoming issue?" I tell them, and they are like, "I don't know that name." And it's often, wait for it, you know. Give it a year, give it 2 years, and they come back to us and say, or we get reports that people say, "Oh, I didn't know that you guys covered that person way back when." So it's also a nice thing to hear.
And that was the first formal Americas that we had. So what's the year on that? It was 2001. So like from 84 to 2001, then it became a formal product.
Twentieth year.
And architecture is a big part of the magazine too, like every, you know, aspect of art, you know, design. Mary Heilman.
Marina was also just honored at Baum's 30th anniversary.
And this is the artist on artist section that we have, like, an artist just writing about another artist's work. And it's, you know, it's not the conversation, but it's, you still get the kind of intimate or the closeness having one practitioner speak about another's work. So that's maybe the closest thing to a review we have besides Editor's Choice. this is Betsy's favorite spread editor. She told me one day she loves the Luke Santi poem. It was the first poem, the Shell Doll, I think it is, in the Luke Santi. But, and I think it's a David Sully too, but this is a little, I mean, it looks like kind of all over the place. This one was one of the early ones, maybe number 4 it was. But, I mean, it's something like later on it became a lot more streamlined or separated out, like with the little bits about writing about art. You see, I mean, maybe that's like an early like form of like a artist on artist, you know, so it became a lot more formalized or something, but it kind of expresses the mix.
This was the cover of our 100th issue, and it was drawn by Jennifer Clifford Danner, and it's a picture of Elizabeth LeCompte as Ophelia. Oh, I'm sorry, is it Kate Volk? Is it? Mm-hmm. It's of Kate Volk, not of Elizabeth LeCompte.
This is kind of like we got into a phase with the Jetsons cover. Look to it.
This was the first issue of our current redesign. It happened in spring of 2009, and this is a Joyce Pensado cover of Homer Simpson, if that wasn't already apparent. Yep, we're definitely tend towards the New York art scene, only because we have to put these writers in conversation with each other and record them. But we are international in the sense that the America's issue represents 25% of our annual issues. So we have a contributing editor cast of about 90 different people from all different disciplines, and they're based all around the world, and so they feed us content, or if they're in Germany or if they're in Japan, they'll conduct an interview for us. So with that in mind, we probably about 60% New York based.
The design now is a lot cleaner, I mean, than the early ones, and it kind of reflects to me, it feels like a computer. It's influenced by a screen, looking at the screen, I think. I don't know if that's, but it all has that sense to me, the kind of dialogue between the two, print and screen.
I'm going to speed up just a little bit because I know we're running short on time. We are. Brings us to our 30th. Carolyn, you asked the question about how much of our archives are up online, and we spent about 3 years digitizing sort of painstakingly, page by page, all of these interviews, and that's now complete. And Matthew, if you're able to go to the first tab, that would be great. All of them are online and searchable as part of the DBOM Digital Archive. In about 2004, the Columbia's Rare Book and Manuscript Library, Columbia University, bought our first 25 years of archives. So all of our multiple edits, our correspondence, our marginalia, audio tapes were purchased by them, and now they're up there and being archived. But at the same time, around 2006, we started digitizing them page by page. So they're all online, and you can search them using this box here. Or if you go to any of the art, Matt, if you don't mind, just click on that. Any of these categories will give you a custom Google search, and you can put it into any string, just like you could in Google, and turn up any number of different results. And we're in the process of digitizing the rest of the magazine now, which will be about another two-year process. That's all the essays, all the editor's choices, all the ephemera, indicia, tables of contents. In about 2008, we launched the Bomb Blog. And if Matt, you're able to go to tab 2, it looks like this now. If you just scroll down, it's a little bit more, I don't know, hip or urban or something. It gives a shorter shorter form sense of what we do. And there's poetry and there's multimedia. There's lots of video and audio. If you just go down one more, we'll leave it on that and maybe come back to it in a second. And just to give you an example of what some of our online material looks like, this is our blog content. This is what we do, the more short form material that's full of multimedia. But Matt, if you're able to go to tab three, we'll show you what some of our web exclusives look like. And I'll embarrass Nathan by showing a photo of him from 2007 when he was the inaugural web exclusive interview. Baum had never done an interview that wasn't in print, but we decided to try it out online. And I might not have mentioned this yet, but we do about 5,000 word interviews, which is a lot to read on any computer, on any screen. But this was so successful that we decided to give it a shot, and now we've done about 70 of them overall. And you can just sort of see, there's a lot of scrolling, there's no doubt, but people do print these, and people bookmark them. It was conducted by Rivka Galchin, and the story starts out with Rivka talking about how she met Nathan, I guess, in the Hungarian pastry shop up by Columbia. So, again, an example of how Baum pairs different artists and writers in conversation fittingly. And so I encourage you all to explore the archive and bounce around the blog, and you're always bound to find something new and exciting. I think I'm probably running close to time. Does anyone have a sense of how much time I have left? That's good? Okay, great. I was going to read a short excerpt from the Jim Shepherd interview, which we've just put up online. It's, Jim Shepherd, but the George Saunders interview. It's really an amazing 10,000-word interview. The first part is online now. This salon's called The Writing Life. You can't get more writing life worthy than reading what Saunders has to say about what it is to be a writer. I was just going to read some excerpts, but I think it's better off if you read it to yourself and imagine his voice instead of hearing it from me. So I thank you for your time and your attention, and we'll be here later if you want to talk to us.
Hi, everyone. If you want to grab a drink or something like that, please feel free to. I'm Andy Hunter. I'm the editor-in-chief of Electric Literature. And can you just, seeing as we have the internet, just bring up the Electric Literature website? You guys can see the naked man that was referred to earlier. Yeah. There he is. All right. So Electric Literature was founded out of kind of my experience at the Brooklyn MFA. My co-editor and I, Scott Lindenbaum, my co-editor and I, were studying under Michael Cunningham, and we were editing the Brooklyn Review, which is a literary journal with a 25-year history. Allen Ginsberg was the advisor for a number of years. Brooklyn's one of the most literary cities in the world, and yet the print run of the Brooklyn Review was about 600 copies, and about 300 of them sat in an adjunct office at Brooklyn College. We really believed that there were better ways to distribute and capture readers' interests in short fiction and literary magazines in general. And at the same time, there was a lot of pessimism in the air about what the future of literary culture was. You had people like Philip Roth who were saying that in 20 years there's going to be no serious readers and that the novel is, as an art form, is going to end. And in general, what people found threatening tended to be digital media or digital culture in general. That there was this idea that everything from Facebook to Twitter to YouTube was going to corrupt our consciousness and turn us all attention deficit disordered and basically remove our ability to engage anything that has substantiation and depth and really says something about the human condition, that we're basically going to become a superficial ADD culture. And you know, the bookstores were having trouble, and they're still having trouble. So there were a lot of reasons to be pessimistic, but at the same time, we really felt that that was a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that just because people are consuming more media digitally, it doesn't mean that they're going to lose the deep human need for storytelling that has always kind of kept human cultures together for 100,000 years and is really the foundation of our identities. And so we envisioned, and the other thing that kind of bothered us was the idea of writers not getting paid. As writers, we wanted to get paid. You know, literary, like mastering literary craft is work that could take a lifetime to master. And while you have a few people that manage to do it, whether they're postal clerks or lawyers or government officials in general, we like the idea of people being able to support themselves for their work. So all these different factors came into play with the creation of Electric Literature. We realized that we could use digital distribution and digital media to both promote literary content and also distribute it. And we realized that with the advent of devices like smartphones, like iPhones, like Kindles, people would actually be able to pay for it, and they pay for it very easily. And unlike, like the web is wonderful for getting an audience because a lot of people can be exposed to your content, and the BOM archive is a perfect example of that. But it's not wonderful for monetizing content. You can't really charge people if you ask them to pay for to read a short story on the web, they'll go somewhere where they can read it for free. But amazingly, they will buy the same story if it's for the Kindle, or they'll even buy it to read it on their iPhone. And if you want print, if you can't bear the idea of reading something on your cell phone, there's new printing technology called print on demand, where you can basically spit out a book if somebody buys it for about $2. So we put all this together, all these new mediums and changes that were going on in distribution and culture and content consumption, and came up with this business model for Electric Literature, which was to publish to devices and to publish print copies as print on demand, to pay writers $1,000 for a short story, and to use the reach of digital and the efficiencies of digital, because it doesn't cost us anything to, we don't have to pay $10,000 to a printer to print 5,000 copies of Electric Literature, and then another $1,000 to ship them everywhere, and then have half of those copies pulped. We print them as they're ordered, and we distribute online, or we distribute digitally, and that costs us nothing, and we can distribute 1,000 copies as efficiently as we distribute 10. So that's the kind of publishing model, which might be boring, but it did enable Electric Literature to exist and to break even and to manage to pay writers and still exist today. Now, as far as using digital culture to mediums to promote it, we've done a number of things. We published a short story by Rick Moody that was written for Twitter. It was 152 tweets, each 140 characters long. And we published it over the course of 3 days. It gained the attention of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and ended up being the catalyst that amassed Electric Literature over 150,000 Twitter followers, which at the time was more than any other book publisher in the world. And I don't know, it still might be, but I haven't checked. And one thing that I want to show you is a few of our videos. If you can, another way that we kind of get literary culture out there in the world is this thing called the single sentence animation, and that we have a writer choose one of their favorite sentences from their stories, and we give that to an artist or an animator, and they do a very loose interpretation. We don't like tell them animate exactly what this says, but rather it's like a riff on it. And so it's an actual creative expression as well, inspired by the writing. And then we give that animation to a musician, and the musician scores it. And so that you have this kind of cultural cross-pollination that is so important for keeping any creative medium like vibrant and engaged with the world. So I'm going to show the first one that we did, which is it's called Olympia. And this is for Michael Cunningham's short story that was in our debut issue. Actually, that isn't even a whole sentence. It's a sentence, a single sentence fragment animation. And that video has been viewed about 9,000 times. Total, all the videos that we've made have been viewed over 150,000 times. So it's a great way for people to get exposed to literary content. And they're done in all different mediums. If you click on Davis, this is a Lydia Davis sentence. And that was from a story published in the second issue of Electric Literature. We've been very fortunate to publish really great writers. Michael Cunningham in our debut issue and Jim Shepherd in our debut issue, whose story, Your Fate Hurtles Down at You, was just won an O. Henry this year, which is our first literary award. And we're very proud of that. Colson Whitehead, obviously Lydia Davis, Rick Moody, Amy Bender, Kevin Brockmeyer. A lot of great writers, and I'm very happy to say that we're publishing Nathan Englander in the next issue. So I could show more movies, but I think I'm just going to introduce Nathan. He's going to be reading a original new piece that I think this is the debut of tonight, and this will be coming out in our sixth issue, which will arrive sometime in late May or early June.
Hi, good evening. Thanks, Andy. The mic should get closer to me. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Because I'm funny. And so I kid. Can you hear me now? You groovy? All right, then. I didn't know if I should dress library or Electric Literature, and I went with Electric Literature. Anyway, you saw the movies, but I'm a fan of them. He just listed a bunch of friends and stuff, but it's such a great, you and I'm so glad to be a part of it. I really wanted a one-line movie. It was a draw. I don't usually write stories. I'll go quick because the story's cut down a ton, but it's still, I'll get in under half an hour. Anyway, just so you know, I feel like there's a Geneva Convention. You should know how long you're sitting for. Anyway, but yeah, this is the has to be the first reading because Andy gave me very brilliant notes, and I was cutting till like 5:15. So I can't have read it before because it's just finished like an hour ago. And I never, I am like a trained circus monkey, and I have not read anything new in public. I can read those other stories. You can kick me awake at night, and I'll start reading sections. But this is the first time we're reading a new story in public in 5 years or something. So. And I don't usually write to order, but I was thinking, everyone acting crazy? Yeah, a little bit? Yeah? It's going to be good? Yeah? Okay. Anyway, but the point is this story's, make it through? Yeah? Groovy, groovy? Is it my pacemaker setting this thing off? Anyway, but I was sort of thinking about the magazine and changing media when I wrote this story, so it's kind of made to order. Here goes, the reader. He sits on a box of books in a storage room piled high with such boxes and remembered the old days as he does every night on the road. A boy by the name of Todd pops in with a cup of coffee. He's younger than the author. Everyone's so much younger now. It's instant, Todd says, handing over the cup. I hope that's okay, the machine, the barista, it's already shut down. Instant's fine, Arthur says, and takes a sip to prove it. This night, this was City 6 or City 8. It was the end of another day of Arthur driving around only to find an empty bookshop. Often the stores didn't even have the books that were ordered, let alone an audience to buy them. Arthur is not ungrateful. This life he'd led, the writing life, it had been beyond his wildest dreams. He'd been treated well over the years, touted and well-received. Still, Arthur had put everything he had into this latest novel, not just emotion, not just all he'd got in the gumption sort of way, but literally all he had. All his time, all his money, a hunk of his life. Of course, this is what every book had asked of him, that he forego all distraction and every comfort, that he simply put his head down and work. But some decades are more delicate than others. And from this one, he lifted his eyes up to discover that he was old. Arthur looks up to see Todd still standing there observing him in his reverie. The boy pulls a handful of creamers from his pocket. He holds the little thimbles out in his palm, reaching right up to Arthur's chin as if Arthur were an old goat at a petting zoo. No thank you, Arthur says, turning away. Intolerant, he says, to lactose, among other things. The last time Arthur read at this store, the barista had not gone home, the staff had not gone home, and the author hadn't drank coffee. The owner poured whiskey while chasing her starry-eyed workers away. Still, they popped in the store excitedly to say, "We don't know where to put the people. They're lined up outside the door." Tonight there is no one, and Todd peers out into the store one final time to check that it's so. "Let's give it 5 minutes," he says, unpinning his name tag. Then he takes out a phone and his thumbs start flying. Arthur wants to tell the boy certain things. He wants to say, 12 years. 12 years on a book. Is that now half your life, young man? He wants to tell Todd, one must stand by one's story. It's the same commitment the liar must make, but here it's about sticking by the truth. In a sudden display of eagerness, Arthur offers to sign stock. Can't return them, Todd says. The distributor's signatures they consider. And here Todd looks up from texting. He has started a sentence he doesn't want to finish. Damaged, Arthur says, doing it for him. Todd nods, and then the thumbs, they're on the move. That you haven't heard of Arthur, that any recognition you may have once had is beyond recalling. An Arthur, even in his own estimation, is no longer worth naming. This doesn't take away from what was. It does not diminish the fine books he wrote. It does not take away from the countless copies bought and read. Beloved books, maybe one signed right to you. The volume itself fallen behind your shelves, or your parents, or maybe it is, yes, your grandparents' book, packed away, molding in the basement, the silverfish eating their way through. At his height, the head of the New York Public Library had waited for Arthur on the front steps of that venerable institution. A patrician man, the librarian stood rigid in the rain between his two sleeping lions, simply to show respect for Arthur coming there to perform. He then took Arthur on a tour of the great halls, insistent on exposing him to the wonders of their collection. "This is the cane Virginia Woolf left on the banks of the river when she waded into the waters," the librarian said, "pockets full of stones." He laid this relic in Arthur's hand for a moment before leading him down below the basin of the old Manhattan reservoir, floor after floor, into the stacks that run deep below Bryant Park. There, the librarian turned a giant nickel wheel parting shelves like the sea and said, "These are the best sellers of the 19th century, where we keep your brothers and sisters, the authors who held your esteemed position 100 years before." Arthur went to look. Arthur expected to find the books he cherished from that time. "Is this?" Arthur said. "Yes, yes," from the librarian beaming, "the giants of the era." Arthur looked again, the spines unfamiliar. Arthur's eyes bounced around the shelves, picking up speed until they were near rolling in his head. He fought off a panic. Arthur had not heard of a one. "Taste changed," the librarian said. "Isn't it fascinating how much?" Arthur had buried the moment away. He'd left it where it sat, deep down below the park, and only now does it come rushing back. All these years later, the author leaves Todd and the storeroom and his ruined career behind. Arthur says thanks to the boy. Arthur says goodbye. And Todd doesn't understand that this goodbye is not just to him and his store and this town, but it's Arthur's goodbye to the whole fucking thing. This last book, Arthur had typed nearly all of it standing up, fighting an aching back and clacking away at his keyboard with arthritic, rope-knuckled fingers. This is how he now worked, the spring gone from his system, bone rubbing against bone. "If you hit the latch thing, it'll lock behind you," is what Todd yells out from the storeroom. Arthur hears this as he heads for the front door, thinking that this is what it's come to. The boy in the back on his phone, wholly unconcerned that someone might already be inside loading up on the great treasures of literature and robbing the store. Arthur skirts the five empty rows of five chairs, horseshoe to give the impression of a decent crowd were they to fill. He keeps his eyes down so as not to see the staff choices or bestsellers, so as not to catch reader favorites or the discount stickers next to the embossed foil prizes awarded to the writers he used to know. Arthur is half out that door when he hears a different voice calling. "Arthur," the voice calls, and then sharper, more demanding. "Writer," it says. "Writer, you came here to read." In the empty store, in those empty chairs, sits, invisible until he speaks, one man. He is small, much smaller than the author who is not big. He is also considerably older, which Arthur thinks must make him at least 110. The man's skin is pale and vitamin-starved. His face hangs loose on his head. Shoved into his mouth like a doorstop is a set of big white teeth that surely sit in a glass by night. The only thing with any life left in it is the hair, boot polish black. This, Arthur can't take his eyes off it. It isn't like those choppers. The hair seems real, vibrant, and undyed. Were Arthur ever to write again, the hair is the detail. He'd write of a drawn old man, shrunk inside his clothes, faith melting like wax, and this smart, this healthy shock of black hair. "You came to read," the man says. "I came to read," Arthur says. The man stands there looking expectant. Arthur pretends to misread the cue he's receiving. He feigns impatience, and when the man continues to hold his ground, Arthur breaks, openly despairing, his voice choked with all the hurt of that night. "A dozen years," Arthur says, "day in and day out, writing, writing all the time. You do not know how many pencils it takes just for the drafting," he says. "Boxes and boxes of pencils." "Now look," Arthur says, "I'm asking you, take a look." The old man joins the author in surveying the empty room. "Call it a night, shall we?" Arthur says. "Yes, let's just call it a career and go home." The old man, at first invisible himself, now produces a copy of the author's book, invisible in his hand. It is well worn in a good way. It looks, in fact, Bible soft, a hardcover read so much that it curls in his grip. "There's an investment for me too," the man says. "A drink," Arthur says. "Wouldn't that be better, more personal? Wouldn't you rather maybe a meal? I'd rather you read. That's what I came for." They stare at each other, study faces, and Arthur. He shakes his head as he hears himself speaking. "Something short," he says, giving in to this ancient man. It's not for me to dictate, the old man says. If it's one word, then one word. The contract, a social contract. It says, if I come, you read. It does, doesn't it, Arthur says, offering a hand and leading the little man to the front row. Arthur takes a seat himself, angling the chair further into the horseshoe, and takes up his book to read. No, the little man says, the podium. What? The podium. We are two, Arthur says. The old man looks back blank. As audience, Arthur says, you are one. He holds up a finger to illustrate. Dignity, a great author. I am, you are, a great author, a mighty author. One or 1 million come to see you still from the podium. Read out, read strong. And now author's first impression seems rash. Author no longer thinks, and he's ashamed not to think it because he knows why he no longer thinks it, that the old man seems so crazy anymore. Author takes his place at the lectern and opens his book. He gives the same introduction he'd give to one or 1 million, the same personal heartfelt warm-up the author used to reserve for the big halls. He remembers a night in Seattle, tripping over the cables running from a TV truck into the theater as he made his way backstage. There, a woman in a headset pulled back the curtain for Arthur and for a moment took hold of his arm. Remember to raise your eyes to the balcony is what she said. You can't see, but they're there. Arthur reads his heart out for this lone man. He reads so hard, his voice booming, the feel of story told overtaking him, the rhythm of sentence running through him, that it puts tears into Arthur's eyes, tears that he lets fall so that he is now reading from memory, so it is now from memory that he reads, turning the pages while the letters swim. It's in the midst of this reverie that he does not, for who knows how long, notice Todd standing there, staring back and forth between the author and the man, a strange thump emanating from him. Todd is trying to distract author, author thinks, trying to take away from this lovely moment. Why else would this deep bass be emanating from him? Author posits that this is maybe some kind of anger radiating off Todd, and then, pulled back to this world, focusing, he understands that the pulse comes from a pair of headphones clamped like hubcaps around Todd's head. Arthur, soaring still, reads on. Driving in darkness toward the next distant city, Arthur knows that what he just experienced was a gift. Really, how much richer could a writing life be than finding, even for one night, one true reader? Arthur rolls this thought around his brain, sucking on it like a sweet, sticky lozenge. He thinks this thought right down to nothing as he barrels along I-80, pulling right at the wheel, his car buffeted by the wind. When the check engine light pops up, glowing on his dashboard, Arthur sees it simply as another small test in the life of the true artist. Check engine, check author, drive on. It does not last long, this feeling. It does not last a full 24 hours until Arthur feels ashamed and embarrassed for having driven so far. Arthur finds himself standing alongside a narrow woman, her wrists girded in copper bangles as if suited up for some obscure form of war. All Arthur can think is, who will she fight in this empty store? Who will even bother to come attacking? The woman is talking to Arthur as she lines up rows of tiny point-of-purchase books. It must be a shock for the once-a-decade novelist, she says. Startling to see how much things have changed. Yes, yes, Arthur says, a book every 10 years, it's like being a cicada, you know? You spend all those years underground busy staying alive, and when you finally burrow your way back out, you never know what world you'll find. 16 weeks and 3 days from now, the lady says, this space belongs to CVS. She waves off the whole situation. The motion sends the bangle scuttling along her arm, giving off a tinny ring. My brother's a pharmacist for them. Wouldn't it be funny if he ended up working right here? It could happen, she says, again setting the bangles to tinkling. It could. The woman has played Arthur's part. She has used the it could meant for him. Now Arthur doesn't know what to say, and so he says nothing, nodding in thanks and heading for the parking lot door. That's when he hears it. Arthur, the voice calls. Writer, where do you go? Arthur stops, blinks, an ear cocked toward the room. Arthur stands with the door in his hand as if he'd just heard his own bird call. Writer, always running, a reading tonight. Before Arthur answers, it's the store owner speaking, her voice enough to knock the little man down. No reading, she says, canceled. Canceled why, the old man says. Canceled how. She looks at him quizzical. No one came. Someone came, he says, but he's not referring to himself. The author came. Look right there, can you see? He holds the door open, letting in the cold. Not worth it, the lady says. No offense, but the time for reading has come and gone. Yes, offense, the old man says. And then he's off, rhapsodizes, singing author's praises. Author does not take it personally. That is, he does not hear the kindnesses as in reference to him. What he hears from this ancient man is a passion for books themselves, someone bitten by the written word. Author hears what he hears as a fellow reader, and author remembers. It was the story of my dovecote. It was Babel read to him by his mother. She'd sat by the side of his childhood bed and read that story to author in Russian. This was back in the days when the language whispered at his bedside still held meaning in author's ears. And look at him now. A lifetime later, and he can still see the whole story as if he himself had lived it. For author, it remained as vivid as first telling, while the Russian was, all of it, gone. When his mother had finished reading, author had asked her if the story was for him. He didn't mean it as metaphor or exaggeration. He was asking sincerely a little boy's question. Had Mr. Babel composed the story for author to hear? His mother, having read him a tale too sad, too dark for a boy so young, had tousled his hair and kissed his head and said, of course, written for you alone, my son. Author, as child, was amazed and overjoyed and filled with wonder. Somewhere a writer had put something out into the world and put it out there for author alone to find. It was an intimacy as real as a friendship. Author looks over at his reader, talking to the bangle-eyed woman, cajoling. Here was author's crackpot, author's madman, and also author's audience. This ancient, ancient man with his shoe-polished hair and cataracts thick as nails through which he reads, and somehow drives. The bookstore lady relents, and author doesn't fight it. He is now truly touched by this man's dedication here to see him a second night. Author reads his heart out for the old man, and when author is done, a chastened bookstore lady approaches with a novel that author humbly signs. It is not for the shop. It is an inscription requested, a book personalized and then returned to its owner. She clasps it to her chest where it sits protected behind that shield of bangled arms. Author is truly thankful for his champion, his upholder. This is what he tells himself when he finds his one loyal reader wearing a yarmulke and sitting front row at a JCC in St. Paul. In a yarmulke himself, author is so grateful for this man who sustains him, who preserves him, who does not turn his back in hard times against him, that the mantra turns to a little prayer. Author recites this from the dais. It comes out of his mouth, a poem. The old man looks thrilled, teeth and hair shining, as he listens to this private devotion, nearly drowned out as it is by the din of evening league basketball blowing through a retractable wall. Afterwards, he produces a crumpled handwritten schedule with the author's next date. Yes, a lovely night this, he says, carefree perusing. But to every gift and every blessing, there is a place where they curdle and turn. The man comes to see him at an empty Brookline booksmith, an empty Three Lives, and an empty Politics and Prose. In Kansas City, when a pair of drunks stumble in mid-reading, come only to suck up the free wine, author slams his book shut, only to hear the cry from his audience of one of, author, read on. Read on, yes, but for how long? Author was a man surviving on memory and the fumes of prestige. He addresses this to his reader forever at his heels in a quaint Pueblo-inspired bookshop in Alamosa. This book, author says, it is not a novel, it's a tombstone. Why not just hammer it in the ground above my head? My name's already on the front. A mistake to make such a request, the reader says. Never die too soon. Too soon. I'm the duck hanging too long on its hook in the window past eating. The only difference? Yes, the reader said. What is the difference between you and the duck on the hook? The duck, author says, at least knows when it's time to be dead. The old man stares at author, considering. My father, he says, he hung himself at 97 years old. He couldn't take it any longer. That's what he said in his note. He didn't want to face living anymore. I'm sorry to hear that. I wish he'd spoken to me, the old man says. I'd have told him. 97. No need for such drastic action, father. Patience. Just give it a little time. Forgive the author his relentless commitment. Forgive his belief that even if the next city promises nothing more than this one old man, still it's his obligation to drive on. A writer never knows if perseverance is his terrible weakness or his greatest strength. And with all those headlights floating divided in his rearview mirror, author can never tell which belong to his reader, which pair is his beacon, a North Star split, cast back and guiding him on. The two arrive at a Denver bookstore, which is now half marijuana dispensary. A scheme, the owner says, while dusting a beloved volume, to use one drug to pay for another. After an empty but for his lone reader reading, it's this man flush with cash and good living who tells author to take any books he wants for his troubles, a gift of the store. Babble, author says, surprising himself, the Odessa stories. He'd not let himself read them since he was a boy. From Denver, author crosses the Rockies toward the Pacific with his reader ever mindful of the speed limit in hot pursuit. At Salt Lake City, author hangs a northerly right and drives up to Vancouver through 3 days of rain. After reading for his reader in that lush city, author turns his car toward the next bookstore, making his way back down the West Coast. The sun is with him this time, and author drives with an arm stuck out the window, cooking his left side to a burn. At a gas station just north of Seattle, author fills his tank with the last of the money he has. He is so strapped for cash that a few miles further on, he stops at a church-run stand by the side of the road. There, he sells the babble he's only just been given for a dollar and watches the lady drop it into a box after marking it for two. The stories, he tells her, are just the way I remember. Pulling into Seattle, a city where author was once truly renowned, he knows, literally and figuratively, how low he's been laid. That his old friend, the buyer for Elliott Bay Books, has arranged to host author for a reading is an act of charity so undisguised it leaves him humbled enough to receive another. Eyes down, author enters the Come Unto Me mission across the street from the bookshop and eats a bowl of soup, his first meal of the day. Inside the bookshop, author gives his name to a pierced-nosed clerk behind the counter. She tells him without any emotion that his reading is downstairs. Author is crestfallen as he approaches the basement steps. Then he hears the noise, and his heart is set aflutter at the sound of a reception in full swing. The energy, he can feel it in his feet through the floorboards. Author fights himself from taking the stairs two at a time. There is indeed a crowd assembled when he reaches the basement. They are coffee drinkers filling a bookstore cafe. Author asks the barista and she points. The reading is in a tiny room beyond. How the noise had confused author. How it had filled him with glee. It was author's great city, and he'd figured on the basis of what, wrongly so. When the book buyer shows up, he finds author waiting in the little room, and the years wash away. All that time, nothing but a blink when there's warmth between two people. They hug, and the buyer says, "You look good, just the same." Before the emptiness of the room sours the moment, the buyer tackles it head on. "I'm really sorry," he says, "it's a great book. This, the no-show, it's not you, it's us. It's been slow this season. Numbers are down." "It's all right," author says. "The whole country for me a desert, empty rooms from sea to shining sea." It feels so good to tell to this nice man who knew how it once was, who'd orchestrated author's glorious sellout night a dozen years before, and yet who, with grace, now acknowledged what is. Not like his reader, not like his shadow drowning him in faith. Author says, "You know what? Let's not even wait. How about for old time's sake? Let's just get a drink, you and me." The buyer considers and then throws an arm over author's shoulder. "Sure, I'd love that," he says. He drops his arm and slides through the cafe towards the stair with the author wistful at his heels. As they climb, author hears it. He is surprised he does with the music and the chatter, but there it is from deep in the mix of the cafe. "Author, writer, it's time to start," is what he hears. "Writer, hello, where do you go?" The book buyer half hears it himself enough to pause, banister in hand. Author won't have it. He keeps climbing, driving the buyer on. An author's old man, too slow to catch up, and all those stairs before him, screams from below with all he's got. "Hey, writer," he calls, and then, "Hey, bookstore man, a customer down here, the writer must read." This the book buyer doesn't miss. "Would you listen to that?" he says. "Your public calling." Before he says more, the author, hangdog, turns and heads downstairs. The reading is starting and no one from the cafe comes in. Conversation continues, the music blares, and it takes no small effort on the part of the buyer to convince the barista to turn the sound system down. There is, the author hears it, a low round of boos. The old man sits in the front row in the tiny three-row back room. Small as it is, there's still a plywood stage a foot high and not much deeper, with a little lectern perched at an angle from which the author will read. The emotion on author's face is clear, and the buyer waits for him to compose himself, so though it's quickly becoming clear that author's despair is anything but subsiding. It seems to be frothing into a rage aimed inexplicably at the frail little man. "Buddy," the buyer says, trying to steer author to the stage, "how about you just give the guy 5 minutes and then we'll grab us that drink?" The buyer, without even noticing it, is kneading author's shoulders and patting his back as if coaxing him into the ring. "Yes, 5 minutes," the old man says. "Now up on that stage, time to start." This sets author off. "Stalker," author screams. "Patron." "Do you understand how crazy it is?" author says. "Do you understand how crazy it is, you?" Author stands silent, visibly shaking. The old man turns to the buyer, assuming he's taken the author's side. Why is the artist a romantic for surviving on a glimmer of hope? Why not the same for the reader? Tell me, why is my commitment a weaker thing? "I came," the old man says. He reads. The author, as if the two men are alone in the world, screams back, "I won't, devil." "Devilish, devilish old man." The old man is laughing. To the buyer, he says, "He'll read, you'll see." And to author, adamant, demanding, "Tell this bookman so he understand. Tell him what's really at stake in your heart and mine." Author does not want to cry. He can feel his eyes wet and goes as far as tipping his head back, praying a tear won't fall. What, the old man says, a hand cupped to his ear. Author says, "It will not, aloud, sound so good." "Tell him," the old man yells, pointing to the buyer. "Tell him why a man like you does what he does." "I write," author says, his face twisted into a wince, "to touch people in the way that I, as a reader, have been touched." And here his expression unwinds. "And if I were still any good at all, it wouldn't just be you two here listening. A failure, I admit it. Now you," he says to the old man, "admit it too." Self-pity, the lament of the aging beauty queen. "No," the reader says, "I won't admit failure for a book written for the ages." The two men stand there facing each other, author now openly weeping. They are caught in a moment so large and so raw that they do not notice that the cell phone ringers have gone silent and the coffee machine has lost its terrible hiss, that the chatter is missing from the next room as the whole of that coffee shop, drawn by the screaming, now crowds around the doorway watching their fight. It's the woman from behind the counter, pierced and tatted and hair streaked blue. "Come on, read," she says, her call immediately backed up by another. "Get up there," someone yells, and another screams, "Hey, one old guy, give the other old guy his due." A sizable audience is forming, gunged up with all his blubbering and sniffling. Author takes his book and takes a stiff-kneed step up to the stage. He will read tonight to a mob. "Oh no," the old man yells, "not this way." He gets behind the door and with feet dug in, he pushes hard against it, attempting to close it on the assembled hipsters who do not immediately retreat. "Out," he yells, "out, out, stylish young people." The old man frees a hand and points at author on stage so that only the pointing hand is visible to those on the cafe side of the door. "This man a legend, not a trained cat from a Russian circus," he yells. "You listen for the right reasons. This is not a monkey who will ride a dog for a show." And when the old man says Russian, author watching from the stage thinks Russian and remembers the story of a promised dovecot. He sees a pair of Babel's bloody birds broken at his feet. The old man keeps on with his pushing until the door is shut. During the scuffle, his black hair is somehow flipped in the wrong direction, his part reversed. That miraculous hair, which author was sure was left by time untouched, reveals itself to be a separate color underneath. It is the sick yellow of straw. Author's reader for once looks his properly petrified age, and the reader, somehow sensing this, hurriedly flips his hair back to where it belongs, his hands so much worse than author's spill over with tremors. "Me and him," the old man says to author while pulling the bookseller to his side. "Why not read for this nice pair who both know and understand?" Author opens his novel to a random page symbolic. He gets ready to read from memory, to recite for his relentless pursuer. He will read the old man's favorite part. Author starts in unintelligible with the echoes of all his hemming and crying and a rattle to his voice. He has not read two lines when he stops. He puts a hand up to signal that he's only pausing, and author pulls from his back pocket a small soft notebook, its spiral gone. It is where author, secretly, involuntarily, and against better judgment, takes his endless notes. It is where he sketches a new book for which no one will wait and from which no one will hear. Pulling the rubber band off it, he knows his reader won't live to see it, even if author soldiers on to see it done. "Something new I've been working on," author says, and the old man nods full of respect. And the bookseller, who has been standing until now, nods as well, taking a seat at the reader's side. And author, who has played bigger and larger, who has under all the pressure in the world executed such evenings with aplomb, he wipes his nose on his sleeve, takes a deep breath, and, leaning down close to the little book, reads on with all he's got. Author reads for Seattle. It has always been his city. He reads for the buyer who has always believed. Author reads one more time to his old man, the perfect night to let it all go. Yes, it is a good night, and for the old man, author is truly thankful. He smiles at his reader and reads on through the tears. Author reads on, and author reads on. Thanks.
Wow, thank you so much. The note about the Phoenix Quartet has disappeared. Someone took it by accident. Anyway, an upcoming event, the Phoenix Quartet. There it is. You're welcome to attend a performance by them. It's a vocal ensemble. They're coming this Sunday, May 1st at 3 o'clock in space. They'll be presenting Songs of Peace, a program of historic and contemporary works with text from Walt Whitman and African American spirituals, among others. You can visit the library's website for details. Thank you all for coming, and please join me in thanking again Baum and Electric Literature and Nathan Englander for this really extraordinary, their extraordinary presentations. And join us for refreshments.